Hi there, it's Marco. Before we get started, I wanted to share some great news. We surpassed the goal for our end-of-year fundraiser. Since the beginning of November, we've been asking you to donate to support the world. From every corner of the globe, people like you answered the call. We raised more than $75,000 to help keep our show going for another year. Your generosity means that our correspondents, editors, and producers can continue to bring you the coverage that you rely on. And it means so much to our entire team to know that you're with us. So thank you once again from all of us here at The World. Now, on with the show.
As Omicron continues to rip across the globe, yet another coronavirus variant has popped up.
Most scientists consider it not something to worry about right now. But from the headlines we're seeing in the media, it's easy to conclude the opposite.
How to distinguish between a scariant and a variant. Also, the head of Britain's spy agency says it's time for a change to make MI6 more inclusive.
Daniel Craig has humanized Bond a bit, hasn't he, in the last couple of movies. But if you go back to the original Bond, it's pretty misogynistic. That's not terribly appealing to many women.
And combining art, literature, history, and cookies.
I'll make a whole set that's inspired by, say, 18th century fashion.
The cookies are quite beautiful, but do they taste good? I'm Carol Hills. Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Just a few weeks ago, the Greek letter Omicron was nowhere on our radar. Now, to most of us, that letter means only one thing, another COVID variant. But just as we're adapting to Omicron, there may be another variant lurking. It's temporarily been named the IHU variant. We wanted to dig deeper into the variant world, so we're turning to Emma Hodcroft, an epidemiologist at the University of Bern in Switzerland. Emma, how does a variant become a variant of interest?
The WHO actually has rules about when they decide that a new variant is a variant of interest or a variant of concern. A variant of interest is the one that's slightly less worrying. This is something that scientists will monitor closely. And this is usually based around the fact that it has some mutations that we think from previous work or from previous variants are worrying, and that we're seeing that variant start to spread in other countries and maybe increase around the world.
So the IHU variant, this new one, is that a variant of interest or officially a variant?
This is just a variant. And I want to be really clear. There are hundreds and thousands of SARS-CoV-2 variants. That's just a term that scientists use to indicate that this is a combination of mutations we haven't seen before. But simply seeing a new combination of mutations doesn't mean that that variant will behave any differently. For this new variant, it's certainly one that scientists have had their eyes on because it has an interesting combination of mutations, some of which we've seen before and have seemed to be bad news. But really importantly, we've been watching this since about the beginning of November, and it hasn't really grown. There are only about 20 to 30 sequences known worldwide. That's really nothing compared to the millions of cases we're seeing of other variants.
So you've said lots of variants come and go, but somebody's identifying and tracking them. Who is that?
That's actually a lot of different people. This is one of the real silver linings of the pandemic, is it's shown what scientists can do when we work together and work openly. On any given day, there are tens or even hundreds of scientists poring over the new data that we get every single day. And that can be up to 20 to 50,000 new sequences. Scientists are looking at what those sequences look like, what mutations they have, and whether we're seeing a pattern in how they cluster. For example, a particular combination of mutations that seems to be increasing somewhere around the world. Scientists will then flag up other scientists and ask for their opinion, and we'll start watching it if it looks like something we want to keep our eye on.
But is there a clearinghouse where all this chatter and observation kind of goes to assess the importance or concern over a variant?
So a lot of this actually happens through pretty informal channels, on Twitter, through email, on Slack, and on a platform called GitHub, which is actually where a lot of this conversation takes place, in part of what we call the Pangolin GitHub, which is a group of English scientists that come up with some of these names. Now, this is just for seeing what we find and reporting it to other scientists. But of course, more officially, things like the WHO, the CDC, and the ECDC then have their rules on when they think a variant is worth giving a more official designation of variant of interest or variant of concern. And that's usually when you start hearing about it in the public.
I guess my final question is, as people hear about these new variants popping up, like the IHU variant, how should they kind of metabolize this information? Who should they pay attention to in terms of whether these variants are important or not?
I do think this is a really great point because, as I said earlier, this new variant was actually detected in November and the first sequences come from October. And we really haven't seen new sequences from this variant anytime recently. So most scientists consider it not something to worry about right now. But from the headlines we're seeing in the media, it's easy to conclude the opposite. So it does show that it's really important to follow a few scientists if you can on Twitter or on Facebook or pay attention to who's talking in the media. I think it shows that we really do need strong bridges between the media and science so that we can make sure that we're getting accurate information to people about what they need to worry about and what's more of a scariant than a variant.
Emma Hodcroft is an epidemiologist at University of Bern in Switzerland, talking to us about how we track, name, and study COVID-19 variants. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
2 years ago this week, the United States and Iran suddenly seemed to be on the brink of war. The spark was an American drone attack at Baghdad's airport that killed Qasem Soleimani, Iran's top military commander. Soon after, Iran retaliated by raining down missiles on a U.S. military base outside of Baghdad. The world's Shirin Jafari looks back at the impact Soleimani's assassination had on the Middle East.
The Iranian state views Qasem Soleimani as a war hero and a martyr. State TV showed people paying respect at the general's tomb in his native city of Kerman. Mourners said they'd come from all over the country. There were also vigils in Iraq, where people lit candles at the entrance of the Baghdad airport where Soleimani was killed in a U.S. drone strike. Over in Lebanon, Hassan Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah, mentioned the anniversary in a speech. Nasrallah criticized the United States for killing the Iranian general, and he said those responsible would face justice in this world and the next. Qasem Soleimani was a powerful figure, not just in Iran. He worked with militias in Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, Yemen, and Afghanistan. Soleimani was revered by some, but also despised by others. Omar Ashokri is from Syria. He was a teenager when he was arrested for protesting against Syrian President Bashar al-Assad.
The death of Qasem Soleimani for a Syrian person who'd been tortured and his family being killed by the Assad regime, who'd been supported by the Iran Revolutionary Guards, led by Soleimani, it's a relief.
Ashokri now lives in the U.S. and advocates for political prisoners in Syria. For him, Soleimani's legacy is clear.
That person being the reason for the suffering of so many Syrian people.
After ordering the killing of the Iranian general in January 2020, President Trump said he had no choice.
Soleimani was plotting imminent and sinister attacks on American diplomats and military personnel.
Trump did not give more details about any planned attacks. But 2 years later, did the U.S. succeed in limiting Iran's influence across the Middle East by killing its top general?
That's a really good question.
Giorgio Caffiero heads the Gulf State Analytics, a risk consulting firm in Washington.
I think Iran remains a very influential power in those countries you just mentioned, Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon.
But that influence, he says, might be on the decline.
Less ability to control Shia militias in Iraq. Soleimani's successor has less leverage over them.
Caffiero says Iraq has seen waves of protests in the past few years, with demonstrators calling for an end to Iranian meddling. David Vitti, retired army colonel who served in Iraq, says Soleimani's replacement, Ismail Qaani, has not risen to the level of his predecessor.
No, I hear lots of comments about that he doesn't speak Arabic. He definitely seems to be more behind the scenes kind of guy. I know he's been to Baghdad after the election, I guess trying to shape the new government, but he just doesn't seem as prominent as Soleimani.
Iranian officials say that Soleimani's assassination is a violation of international law. Over the weekend, they sent a letter to the United Nations calling for accountability. Iran has also promised revenge. And this week, the U.S.-led coalition in Iraq said it shot down two armed drones that targeted a base hosting American troops. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Each New Year's Day, Haitian leaders travel to the northern port city of Gonaïves to celebrate their country's independence. In 1804, Haiti became the world's first Black-led independent country and the first nation in the Western Hemisphere to abolish slavery. This year, a ceremony was organized as usual in Gonaïves, but things didn't go as planned. Haiti's Prime Minister, Ariel Henry, arrived there to make a speech, but as he and his entourage exited a local cathedral, they came under fire. Journalist Jessica Thomas has been following the story closely from Port-au-Prince. Jessica, the Prime Minister's office is describing the clash as an assassination attempt. Is that what it was?
Let's say that, first of all, the Prime Minister was warned by the local authorities. He received threats from armed groups via social medias and local medias telling him that he was not welcome in Gonaïves. And the week before he came, there was a lot of turmoil. People has been shot. People were working on the constructions of the stands where he would give a speech. Armed men were seen in some streets of Gonaïves, and he wanted to go anyway.
Did Prime Minister Henri say why he decided to go anyway, despite those threats?
It's an open secret in a way, because Jovenel Moïse hasn't been able to go over there during his last mandate. And the Prime Minister wanted to go and make a statement that he is the authority in the country.
And Jovenel Moïse was the previous president of Haiti who was killed. Haiti's Prime Minister always travels with a large security entourage. Still, are there many parts of the country that are simply unsafe for him to travel to?
There are many places that are unsafe because the gangs, they control key areas. Like you have the one who kidnapped the 17 missionaries. They control the road, the principal road to go to the border. And in Martissan, which is a main road to go to the south, you have in the north, in Canaan, Port-au-Prince is the heart of Haiti, or the economic heart of Haiti. That's where all the institutions are. And the gangs, they realize that. That's why they're blocking the main roads. It's not safe to go by road in Haiti to many places right now in Haiti.
That's incredible. So all the main roads going in and out of Port-au-Prince are controlled by the gangs?
Exactly. One day it's good, one day it's not good. For example, in Martissan, over the last months, Martissan is a death trap. A lot of people died from Martissan, young people or children. They would just be walking in those areas and gangs would just go outside. Either they get robbed or they get killed.
Mm. Now, it's been about 6 months since gunmen broke into the home of Haiti's president, Jovenel Moïse, and murdered him. Yesterday, authorities in Panama arrested a former member of the Colombian military who's wanted in connection with the killing. Tell us about this suspect, Mario Antonio Palacios.
Nobody knows how he left Haiti, but somehow they found him in Jamaica after the assassination. And the Haitian government has been trying to have him sent back here in Haiti. But there is no extradition treaty between Haiti and Jamaica. But now Jamaica was trying to send him back to Colombia. And from Colombia, while he was going to Panama yesterday, we had news that he was held in Panama. And Panama asked him to go to the United States voluntarily, or they will arrest him. Because one thing we know that there is an Interpol, an international warrant against him.
Journalist Jessica Thomas has been telling us about the deteriorating security situation in Haiti. She joined us from Port-au-Prince. Thanks so much, Jessica.
Thank you.
Coming up, an artist who knows her canvas is less than perfect.
You've got to be quite bold to spend a long time painting something and then sort of destroy it a little bit.
That canvas is a cookie, some of the most beautiful cookies you've ever heard about. Stay with us for that. You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. In the old days, spy agencies lurked in the shadows. Officially, they didn't exist. The heads of these agencies never gave journalists interviews. But times have changed.
It is important that from time to time, I come onto this type of show to explain a bit about what we do.
That's the head of Britain's spy agency, known as MI6. His code name is C. His real name is Richard Moore, and he spoke to Anne McElvoy on the podcast The Economist Asks. Anne joins me now. Welcome, Anne.
Hello.
Why did Richard Moore talk to you, and what did you talk about?
Well, this is something of a departure for MI6, which is British Foreign Intelligence. It works very closely with American intelligence agencies and others in the West. It's a very calculated conversation on his part. He clearly wasn't going to talk a lot about operational details, though I did push him a bit on that. But I think he felt that he needed to make a cultural change for MI6.
The reason I floated this paradox of needing to be more open to stay secret is related to the way we go about doing our business. We're an overseas human intelligence service. That means that we have to recruit and run clandestine agents. And the way in which you do that has to evolve over time.
And Carol, I think really what he's alluding to there is that a big change in MI6 since he came into the leadership has been much more awareness and overt awareness of the gender and particularly racial imbalance in the service. He said himself that when he took the job, the shortlist was all white, all straight and all men. And he does admit that it's been difficult to overcome.
We have to deal with quite a lot of mythology around us. Daniel Craig has humanized Bond a bit, hasn't he, in the last couple of movies. But if you go back to the original Bond, it's pretty misogynistic. That's not terribly appealing to many women. We have to work very hard to reach out to black British people. And then, very obviously, I think for young British Muslims, there is the barrier to get through around terrorism, the portrayal of Islam. So we have many people from those communities in our service. It's just that we don't hit the national average, and I want us to do that. I want us to be fully representative of the country we serve.
It's interesting. He mentions Daniel Craig, an actor, 007, as the humanizing element.
Yeah, that is funny, isn't it? You could argue about whether James Bond has been a good recruiting agent, but just the fact that he's prepared to talk about that semi-seriously, but also to make the point that images do put certain communities off thinking of working with the intelligence services. You know, if you'd asked me 10 years ago, Carol, I've covered intelligence matters for a long time, I would have said, no, that's not going to happen.
Now let's move to intelligence gathering itself, which has changed a whole lot since 1987 when Moore joined MI6. These days, there's cameras in every corner, facial recognition software. How has that affected things?
I think it has created much more of a bridge between that sort of technological capacity to build intelligence, facial recognition software. But the point he was making is how that links with human intelligence and being able to read risks correctly by having people on the ground. And also sometimes as it gets harder and harder to recruit, China would be a very good example at the moment. How are you going to do that if you can't recruit human sources easily within a country? And I think they're thinking in a much more elastic way about that.
So it's interesting. Moore says the bread and butter of intelligence is still the importance of humans and human intelligence and reading one's enemies correctly, you know, by having people on the ground. I mean, how is that going?
Well, you could say Afghanistan had been a bit of a failure on that score. The speed of the fall of the Taliban and the utter chaos and damage that was done in the process. Neither the US nor Britain, as close allies on that mission, read it particularly well, or politics overrode it. He admitted that that was regressive. It was not a good moment. But one thing I was pressing him in was, well, if that didn't work so well, what did you learn from it? And here's what he had to say.
You know, one thing I do take comfort from is that we have learned a huge amount. If I compare it to where we are vastly better at doing counterterrorism work. We have a vastly better network across the globe of partners who do this work. So there is a resilience around this, I think, that was not there in the run-up to 9/11. And that gives me some hope.
That's Richard Moore, head of Britain's spy agency, MI6. He was a recent guest on the podcast, The Economist Asks, with host Anne McElvoy. Anne, thanks for sharing parts of your conversation with him.
Great to be with you, Carol.
Odds are you've either decorated or eaten some kind of cookie over the past few weeks, whether it was to celebrate a holiday or your pandemic baking hobby. But no matter how carefully you iced and sprinkled your treats, one baker in the UK surely has you beat. The World's Bianca Hillier has the story.
Ella Hawkins is an academic by trade. She focuses on costume design from the Elizabethan and Jacobean eras. Think Shakespeare. But on the weekends, Hawkins turns into a bit of a magician in the kitchen and puts her research across many centuries onto cookies.
I'll make a whole set that's inspired by, say, 18th century fashion. So there might be different kind of fabric styles, different patterns, different forms of ceramic all coming together into 8 rectangular biscuits.
Biscuit, by the way, is the word for cookie in the UK. You'll hear both in this story. But you certainly wouldn't guess these treats are edible at first glance. Each one is slightly smaller than a playing card and can take up to 3 hours to decorate.
And they can be quite sort of 3D.
All of that lace, embroidery, and gold detail you'd expect on Romeo's getup is meticulously translated to the cookie.
I'll pipe patterns using something called royal icing, and there'll be sort of a lot of color going on. Sometimes I'll hand paint them, and they can be quite intricate.
You've got to see this for yourself. Check out pictures on our Twitter. We're at The World. You'll see that Hawkins does stray from costume designs. On some cookies, she paints plants so real I'd expect an earthy smell rather than a sugary one. There's also a set of stained glass cookies that I swear I can see light shining through. But not all of Hawkins' baked goods are supposed to look pristine.
I made a set that were based on ancient Greek pottery shards.
The freshly baked cookies, though, didn't look very ancient. So Hawkins started an aging process.
If you just scratch at the biscuit surface, it very quickly makes it look sort of like it's been in the ground for a long time. You can use edible food coloring to just kind of splodge all over it to make it look dirty. You've got to be quite bold to spend a long time painting something and then sort of destroy it a little bit.
Speaking of destroying the cookies, they may look too good to eat, but Hawkins says each one is thoroughly enjoyed.
I often send them as gifts to family and friends. And that's actually what got me doing it so often recently. It was during the pandemic when I wasn't seeing family and friends. I would bake and sort of that would be a way of sort of showing them I love them, is spending all this time on these sort of beautiful things that they could receive in the post and then eat and enjoy.
Yep, these cookies taste good too.
I try and theme the flavors around what the designs are. So there was a set based on pottery fragments from the River Thames. And they were sea salt flavored.
If you're thinking about how you can get your hands on one of these cookies, sorry, they're not for sale. You just have to be friends with the baker. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
More stories from around the globe are coming your way. You're listening to The World. Canadian potato farmers are in a jam. Their government won't let farmers on Prince Edward Island export their spuds to the U.S., creating a huge pileup.
Enough potatoes to fill 25 NHL hockey arenas with potatoes piled 2 stories high.
Just think of the French fry possibilities. That's coming up on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World, a co-production of GBH and PRX. The DMZ, the demilitarized zone which divides North and South Korea, is one of the most heavily militarized strips of land on the planet. But over the weekend, an unidentified young man apparently managed to cross the DMZ undetected. He wasn't escaping from the impoverished, repressive government in North Korea, though. He was returning to the North from South Korea. Officials in the South say the man was a defector who arrived 2 years ago the same way he fled. So he actually appears to have crossed the DMZ not once, but twice. On the line with me now is Donald Kirk, a reporter based in South Korea who writes about Northeast Asia for the Daily Beast. Donald, what do we know about what happened here? I mean, can you give us more details?
Well, it seems that the man was just not happy with life in South Korea. He was working sort of as a janitor or a cleaning person. He probably was not making a lot of money, didn't have a lot of social contacts, and was extremely lonely. This is the case with a lot of defectors from North Korea. There have been about nearly 34,000 of them over the years, increasingly fewer of them in the last few years as North Korea has really tightened up its border.
Now, of course, to most of us, it's hard to imagine getting out of North Korea and then wanting to return. I mean, just how bad was his life in South Korea, you know, that would motivate him to take such a risk to go back?
Well, it was probably a pretty lonely, desolate life, and he wasn't making a lot of money, didn't have a lot of social contact. That's the case with quite a few defectors. They discovered that the South Koreans, after they go through an initial program, 3-month indoctrination or training program into what life is like in South Korea, they go through that after they get out into society. they find that they're not always that welcome. They're making considerably less than the average South Korean. And it's a tough life. And then they start yearning for their old life in North Korea. Of course, they don't like the repressive regime. That's why they left in the first place. But they had contacts there. They had a village life or some kind of a life that they yearned to which they yearned to return.
Have any South Koreans said, oh, yeah, I knew that guy. He lived next door. I mean, has anybody kind of in South Korea kind of recognized the person and said much about him?
Well, there was a report that where he was living, he was seen throwing away some of his bedding and other stuff. And a neighbor saw this and was wondering, hey, what's going on? But apparently didn't talk to him. He didn't really communicate that much. Now, the police had heard that he wasn't happy with life in South Korea and that he had problems and so forth. But they never thought that he had so much of a problem that they should really watch him carefully and stop him from re-defecting, as they say.
So how are people in South Korea reacting to this? I mean, and what's the government's take on this incident?
The government's take goes on two levels. In the first place, the defense ministry wants to know how on earth this guy got through the demilitarized zone. First, he had to get past South Korean military people. Then he had to get past detectors, the surveillance facilities that they have. And finally, he had to get over the fence. And you can be sure, it may not be publicized, but you can be sure that some senior military officers right down the chain of command, down to the local company commander, are going to be in serious trouble. Now, that's one level. The other level is thinking about what it is that you have to do to integrate the North Korean defectors into South Korean mainstream society. That's another problem. And what it is that makes it so difficult for some of them, and how do you make life simpler and easier for them and better for them?
Well, I was going to ask, I mean, how important are defectors from North Korea when it comes to the propaganda war that each side wages against the other?
Well, they're very important. Thousands and thousands of people from North Korea want to get out. Most of them are in China. And many of them have some kind of jobs, often demeaning jobs, women forced into marriage, and men not doing very much, maybe working on farms and trying to avoid the Chinese authorities who throw them back into North Korea when they find them. And when they're sent back to North Korea, they get into deep trouble. They're imprisoned. Some of them, there have been tales of beatings and torture and even executions.
Do most North Korean defectors, when they get to South Korea, do they end up just hanging out with other North Korean defectors?
Well, quite a few of them hang out with other North Korean defectors. There have been cases where they've gotten married. There have also been cases where they've been working together. There's not really an organization, a defectors organization, to which they can all go for morale building, lectures and training and that kind of thing.
Donald Kirk is a reporter with The Daily Beast. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Silvana Estrada is a rising star in Mexico. She's only 24 and hasn't even put out her first full record. But Estrada has already grabbed a huge amount of attention with a style of music that's decidedly more traditional than pop. The World's Latin America correspondent Jorge Valencia sat down with Estrada in Mexico City to talk about her upcoming debut album, Marchita.
Te he perdido tantas veces.
The first single has the same name as the album. In Spanish, Marchita means withered. It's a love story.
Y si yo hubiera sabido que para ti era tan poco.
In fact, it's a love story that Silvana Estrada has been thinking about for years. We met on a rooftop, the Mexico City sun shining down on us. And she says she has told the story so many times.
I'm not able to actually remember how it was.
Every time she retells it, she says she gives a different version.
I'm going to give you a version.
It's the story of Estrada's first love, she says. She's written about it in many of her songs, including one of her most famous, Al Norte, or To the North.
Que por ti me voy al norte, que por ti me voy al sur. That song is like about chasing your love. It's like it doesn't matter if you're going to the north or to the south. And it doesn't matter if there's a destiny, because the important thing is that I'm going with you.
Eventually, that beautiful relationship she chased after, Yeah, it ended. Estrada's then-boyfriend skipped town, and she says she realized she'd been leaning on him to take care of her instead of relying on herself. She says she wrote Marchita, this new single, to remind herself she can be happy on her own, doing things like yoga.
Yeah, I do yoga a lot. Yoga heals me a lot, so I do a lot of yoga. I walk a lot. I read a bunch of poems and books, and for me that's like the best moment of my day.
When Estrada began composing Marchita, she was no longer living where she grew up, in a house in a forest in Mexico's Gulf state of Veracruz, and she was struggling with big city life.
Totally. I was like really having a rough time. I just moved here, and I was living in this really tiny, tiny place.
She says she was living next to a busy highway, getting very little sunlight and lots of noise, which Mexico City is full of. Like the junk collectors who drive around blasting their advertisement on loudspeakers, or the ubiquitous trucks hawking bread. After you hear them enough times, you start to lose your mind a little.
It was really, like, rough.
So Estrada began experimenting with a genre that reminded her of being out in the country, the traditional Mexican huapango. She plays a small four-string instrument called the Venezuelan cuatro.
Yeah, you know, I was just playing with these minor chords.
Estrada says that as she was playing in that dark, crammed, and noisy room, she thought of a withered flower.
Started from there, actually. It wasn't like, oh, I want to talk about this story of mine. It was like, oh, I want to say this word because I feel like this withered flower that I have in my head.
The result is anachronistic. Marchita, the song, and the whole record has a vintage vibe in that it's mostly Estrada's voice and her acoustic cuatro. She says she did experiment with more modern electronic arrangements.
Of course, I was like, oh, that's the music now, so I should do that. But I felt sad having these danceable moments. I was like, why I feel this way? Like, I don't feel me.
Instead, Estrada went in the opposite direction. Her parents are luthiers and make violins, cellos, and double basses. So she and producer Gustavo Guerrero got musicians to perform music that reminded her of home.
I would be like, hey, play this melody in this part.
No? And that's the ending of Marchita, a love story that's really about how Silvana Estrada learned how to take care of herself.
I learned to follow like my instinct, and I also learned if you're honest, then you're going to be happy, or at least you're going to be in peace. Sometimes peace is better than happy, you know? No hubieras querido esta
canción. For the world, I'm Jorge Valencia in Mexico City.
If keeping up with world news is one of your New Year's resolutions, we've got something for you. Our morning newsletter gives you three top stories of the day, some of the world's reports you might have missed, and of course, a curious story to brighten your day. It comes from our editors straight into your inbox. Sign up for our newsletter, Top of the World, on our website, theworld.org. More bad financial news coming out of Turkey. Inflation there has hit a 19-year high. That's just one of many concerns in Turkey at the moment. The nation is also dealing with a migration crisis. Millions of Syrians have fled to Turkey. Many want to continue on to the European Union. But the borders are shut, and increasingly, these Syrians are feeling unwelcome in Turkey. Our next story is about the obstacles migrants there are facing, including disinformation, and one Syrian man's determination to reach Greece. Photojournalist Özge Sebzeci reports from Turkey.
In a workshop on the outskirts of Istanbul, İsa Ramazan is hammering a pair of black flats to be sold in stores in Russia and Western Europe. He says he's been a shoemaker for almost four decades. I studied until the sixth grade and I started doing shoemaking, he says. It's my father's profession. Ramazan was 35 when the war broke out in his home country of Syria. He packed up his family and moved to Turkey. They've been here ever since. His mother is Turkish and he speaks the language fluently, but Ramazan has never been able to get legal permission to work in Turkey or Turkish citizenship. He supports his four children on his wages at the workshop here, paid under the table. But he wants to build his own business and provide more for his children. He wants to return to Athens, where he worked as a shoemaker in the 1990s. Turkey is the world's largest host of refugees and home to 3.6 million Syrians. But 10 years after the war, many still face uncertainty and are trying to get to Europe, despite the difficulties. Almost 2 years ago, in March of 2020, I was with İsa Ramazan, sitting on a bus full of Syrian and Iraqi refugees on the way to the Greek border. At the time, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdoğan unexpectedly announced that his government would no longer stop people from leaving Turkey and crossing into Europe. Thousands of people believed him and crowded onto buses like this one, desperate to try their luck. That went on for a couple of weeks until coronavirus cases became widespread in the country. Ramazan knew it wouldn't be an easy passage. But as darkness fell, we passed the checkpoint and entered a small village, far from the official border crossing. A police commander got on the bus and told the passengers that in order to get to Greece, they would have to get in a small boat to cross the river, dodging the patrols. The commander insisted that after they cross, they will walk until morning to reach Hungary. But I knew he was wrong. That border would take days to reach. An Iraqi woman said she was scared of drowning. She asked if there's another way to cross to Greece. Lady, what do you want? The commander snapped. Do you think they are waiting for you with flowers in their hands on the other side? Greece or Istanbul? The bus driver screamed. You can't stay here. Eventually, the passengers decided they couldn't take the risk, and the bus turned back to Istanbul. This may have been the smart choice. Hundreds of other migrants remained stuck on the border between Turkey and Greece for weeks in the forest. They stayed out in the cold, running out of food. On the drive back, the bus driver turned the radio up loudly to an old song about a man longing for a former lover. Why are they doing this? Ramazan wondered aloud. Why tell people that the doors to Europe are open, but then force them to cross a river in the dead of night? Turkey's open border policy ended, but it sent a message that Turkey had had enough of the 4 million people who have taken shelter there, from Syria, Iraq, now Afghanistan. Today in Istanbul, Ramazan says he's tried to leave for other times.
İki kez Yunan'da yakalandım, iki kez Türk şehrinde.
I got caught two times in Greece and two more times by Turkish police, Ramazan says. When he actually made it across the border and stood on Greek soil, he was arrested and deported back to Turkey. Most advocates consider these deportations illegal. These trips have cost him thousands of dollars in smugglers' fees.
Ben denemek istiyorum. Çünkü ben Avrupa'ya, ben Yunanistan'a.
I want to keep trying, Ramazan says. I want to go to Europe. I want to go to Athens, Greece. So today, when he hears about migrants stuck on the border in Belarus or drowning in the sea, he sees himself.
Medeni insanlar diyorlar ya. Bu mu medeniyetlik?
Is this civilization? Leaving people in the cold, torturing them. Is this humanity? He asks. Is this what the European Union is all about? And yet, he says he will keep trying. There is nothing else for him to do. For the world, I'm Özge Sebzeci in Istanbul.
You can hear a longer version of this story on the international news podcast On Spec. Their latest season focuses on the impact of disinformation campaigns around the world. Britain's Prince Andrew is back in the spotlight today. His lawyers are fighting to have a sexual assault lawsuit against him dismissed. The case has been brought by Virginia Giuffre, who previously accused Jeffrey Epstein of sexual abuse and of trafficking her to Prince Andrew and other men. Giuffre settled her case against Epstein in 2009. For more on today's hearing, the World's Orla Barry joins us. Orla, remind us of the allegations Virginia Giuffre made against Prince Andrew.
Well, Giuffre accused Prince Andrew of sexually abusing her when she was 17 and therefore a minor under US law. She alleges that Andrew abused her on three occasions: on a trip to London in 2001, at Ghislaine Maxwell's home. Then she says he abused her again later in New York, and then on a private island that Jeffrey Epstein owns. Prince Andrew has vehemently denied all the allegations made by Giuffre, who was known at the time as Virginia Roberts. Giuffre is her married name. Most notably, he denied the allegations in a BBC interview with presenter Emily Maitlis in 2019.
You can say categorically that you don't recall meeting Virginia Roberts, dining with her,
yep,
dancing with her at Tramp,
yep,
or going on to have sex with her,
yes,
in a bedroom in a house in Belgravia.
I can absolutely categorically tell you it never happened.
Do you recall any kind of sexual contact with Virginia Roberts
then, or
any other time?
None whatsoever.
Now, Virginia Giuffre was not one of the women involved in the recent Ghislaine Maxwell trial, the woman who was convicted of trafficking teenage girls for Jeffrey Epstein. Isn't that right?
That's right. She didn't testify in the Maxwell trial. Giuffre signed a settlement agreement with Epstein in 2009 after she had accused him of sexual assault and trafficking. In the settlement, Epstein agreed to pay her $500,000 if she agreed to never pursue any further action against him or any other potential defendant, as the document put it. And Prince Andrew's team argued today that this document shows that Giuffre cannot take any further action. But Giuffre's own legal team argue that the terms of the settlement were too vague and too broad, and that they don't prevent her from taking specific action against Prince Andrew.
So, Orla, at this point, what is Prince Andrew's reputation among the British public?
It's pretty much in tatters, to be honest. I mean, he had to step down himself from public life in 2019 after the allegations came forward from Virginia Giuffre. He hasn't really been seen in public life since. And, you know, even if this case is dropped, Carl, people are still going to ask questions about it, because why would his team go to such lengths to have the case dropped if there were questions to be asked? That's what people are saying today. You know, there must be more questions to be asked if they're so vociferous about having the case dropped rather than trying to clear his name, for example. And by all accounts, Andrew was a very good friend of both Epstein's and Maxwell's, both of whom were convicted of child sex trafficking. He brought them to Windsor Castle. He brought them to Balmoral. These are two key residences of the Queen. And that certainly isn't a good look for a member of the royal family.
What has the royal family said about all this?
Well, as is the case with the royal family, in terms of any unpleasant matters, they've tried their best to stay out of it. They're not exactly known as a family of great communicators. Any queries to Buckingham Palace about Prince Andrew are usually just referred straight back to Andrew's own personal legal and PR teams. Although it should be said, for Prince Philip's funeral a few months ago, the Queen's husband and Andrew's father, the Queen did have him lead the personal tributes to Philip, which some say indicates she is still supporting him. And also, Carl, it's understood that she's the one footing the bill for Andrew's lawyers in this hearing today. So you can be pretty assured no money is being spared.
The World's Orla Barry. Thanks a lot, Orla.
You're welcome, Carl.
Farmers in Canada's smallest province got some bad news in November.
Prince Edward Island cannot export fresh potatoes to the United States. The Canadian Food Inspection Agency made that call after potato wart was discovered at two farms in
By October. Order of the Canadian government, no exports of Prince Edward Island potatoes to the U.S. Joining us now to discuss all things potatoes is Greg Donald. He's manager of the Prince Edward Island Potato Board, which represents the farmers. Greg Donald, what is potato wart?
Potato wart is a fungal disease that causes abnormalities, I'll say, on the surface of the potato. It doesn't make the potatoes unhealthy. You can still eat them. But unfortunately, it can last a long time in the soil, and that's why it's a quarantinable pest.
So you haven't been able to export your potatoes to the U.S. since November, isn't it?
This is the seventh week, actually.
Who initiated this thing? Was it the U.S. that asked Canada to stop exporting PEI potatoes?
It's an interesting thing. That is correct. Yeah. Even though we have a management plan in place here that's been in place for years, it's never been exported to anywhere as we do business with. It's been contained. The plan has worked exactly the way it's supposed to. These are very isolated, small cases. And that plan was already agreed to by the U.S. But for some reason this year, the U.S. had a concern and expressed a concern over this pest.
I guess what I don't get is that it's the U.S. that said, we're not going to take any of your potatoes, but it's Canada that then took the action to say, we're not PEI, you can't export any potatoes to the U.S. So
yeah,
why is Canada doing U.S.'s bidding on this?
Yeah, and that's a question we've asked right from the get-go, to be honest. And this isn't my answer, but the answer we've gotten back from CFA and our federal government is that it was the best of not good options. And they felt that if they let the U.S. put a federal order in place, their experience with a federal order, like banning our potatoes, essentially, that it would take years to have it lifted.
So meanwhile, you've got a whole bunch of potatoes on your hands that you can't sell to the U.S. So how many potatoes are in backlog there?
As of Sunday evening, it's about $15 million worth of potatoes that haven't been shipped.
That's the dollar amount. But physically, what are we looking at here?
So the volume of potatoes that we would normally move to the U.S. Would be enough potatoes to fill 25 NHL hockey arenas with potatoes piled two stories high.
Are they all stacked up somewhere, or are they in individual farmers' yards or whatever?
Yep. So they are in farmers' warehouses, but they can only be kept so long. And some of the varieties that don't store as long, they're getting to the end of their storability right now. So if the border doesn't open, some of those potatoes will have to be destroyed probably in the next week.
How many farmers are affected by this?
We have about 175 potato farmers. And I would say one way or another, Carol, most of those farms, one way or another, have been affected. It's terrible.
So what now? What's the next step here?
Right now, it's between CFIA, Canadian Food Inspection Agency, and the U.S. Department of Agriculture, APHIS, their regulatory body. And if there's technical issues, what are they? What do we need to address to bring this to a resolution?
Greg Donald is manager of the Prince Edward Island Potato Board. He was telling us about the impact on farmers there of a ban on the sale of potatoes to the United States. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carol Hills. We'll see you back here tomorrow.